Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, welcome to the Deceptively Fast podcast. Today, I just hung out with my friend Drew Hodgdon. Follow him on Twitter, at Drew Hodgdon. This has turned into probably one of my favorite parts of the week, is just hanging out and talking on the phone with my friend Drew. This podcast, I am using very selfishly as a way to mostly just keep in touch with old friends. So whether you love that or whether you hate it, feel free to give a review if you love it. If you hate it, don't leave a review. But if you like just hearing me talk to Drew and the various other people, leave a 5-star review. That would be awesome. Subscribe so it shows up in your inbox, and enjoy the show. Drew, my friend, how was your Christmas?
It was middling, 4 out of 10.
We're currently recording this in the middle of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers Detroit Lions game, and I don't want to mess something up in case Detroit comes back here, but it looks like it doesn't look like Detroit's going to win this game. It's currently 40-7 in favor of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. I don't even see how the Lions, I turned my head and the Lions had scored. I'd completely checked out on this. You know, they said something interesting in this game, Drew, and I want to get your thoughts on it. And I don't think I told you this beforehand. Mark Schlereth was saying that when he talked to Tom Brady said early in the season, he didn't get as much time working with the receivers as he typically does. And I was thinking, oh, okay, here comes the COVID talk. But no, it was because it's so hot out in Tampa that they just didn't get as much work done on the field. And my first thought was like, oh man, there's people at home thinking like, what the hell's wrong with these people? They can't. Tom Brady's too soft to work out in the heat. But I never really would have thought of, I honestly had the same knee-jerk reaction, but then I remembered what it's like trying to play football in Florida and Texas. And I mean, and you played in Arizona in college too. There is, like, physiologically, there's a limit to how much you can get done before you start getting diminishing returns.
Yeah, there is. Yeah. I mean, it's a full on, that's what was funny, is that having gone from ASU and being out in Phoenix and Scottsdale and then being drafted to Houston, and you obviously were there before I was, and getting there and realizing that there is something to it when people are saying that, yeah, it's a dry heat. Yeah. I mean, it was 125 degrees sometimes when I was in Arizona. Oh. And it was somehow was more manageable.
Oh, really? So it actually, yeah. I always wondered about that, because I thought that, because once it gets up to 125, like that desert heat, I would have figured it still wouldn't matter because it's so intense and the sun is so intense.
It's brutal. It feels like your skin is burning, like the surface layers are literally on fire. But it doesn't sap your energy in the same way that it does when you're just sweating buckets like you do when you're in Houston.
Well, I noticed a difference even going from Jacksonville to Houston. Because Jacksonville, I looked this up once.
All right.
I want to say the three heat indexiest cities in the NFL are Jacksonville, New Orleans, and Houston. And I think it goes in the order of New Orleans, Houston, Jacksonville. But I figured I spent 5 years in Jacksonville. When I got to Houston, it would be no big deal. And I don't know what it is, man. And I think maybe it's just because it's so much more urban. So, like, there's more concrete and everything.
Right.
But that first year in our training camp, I was thinking about retiring. I had those moments, you know, during training camp that I hadn't had since college when 2-a-days actually really suck. Like, where I'm like, screw this. This bullshit. I don't need
Houston,
this shit anymore.
Houston is rough. I mean, Houston was really taxing. Like, yeah. That was a rough time being outside for hours at a time.
So Tom Brady has never had to deal with that because he played at Michigan, then he played at New England. So I guess I wonder if he tried to do it like the first week or two and then realized that it was just too much, or the receivers, like, and the receiver, you know, like Mike Evans and Chris Godwin were probably talking to each other like, crap, I don't want to be the one to tell Tom that we can't do this extra work, but I'm miserable. Sure. My legs don't work.
Yeah, there were a series of weeks that went by where they all pretended to be just as tough and dedicated, and no one wanted to be the one to say it to Tom Brady. Like, yeah. Everyone is just quietly pacing around him, like, who's going to tell him?
Okay. Well, they did have, I don't know, maybe they did have a bunch of injuries those first, really, like, the first half of the season. Maybe that was part of it. Maybe like, somebody had to talk to Tom about, like, hey, like, we just can't. We got all this body. I bet they have the body tracking technology and everything, which I'm guessing, like, Belichick thinks is the devil. So, like, all this stuff that Bruce Arians is going to be different about, like, with a more lax attitude. Right. There was, like, it was probably Tom Brady kind of trying to figure out, all right, I gotta fit into this culture without forcing too much of mine on, and maybe this is part of it.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I bet he was bringing that New England mentality, and it was just like, probably, I mean, I'm sure it was ruffling feathers with some of the guys who were a little more chill.
There is, I remember my brother, when my brother finished college, before he went to grad school, he came down and lived with me in Jacksonville for a while, and he just, like, picked up some random job roofing, and he started off the first week working like he was used to working on the farm up in upstate New York, you know, where, like, every now and then it gets above 90, and he's, like, scurrying up and down these ladders with shingles and everything. And everybody's looking at him like, what the hell is wrong with this moron? This freaking dullard's going to get heat stroke. And he did. Within like 3 or 4 days, he realized, oh, this is why everything's a little bit slower down south. Like, going back to the days before air conditioning and everything, especially, you can't work the same way. You'll die, literally.
No, it's different. I don't know if you had this experience when you were in Houston where you sweat so much that your cleats actually are, like, sloshing around.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, you step down and the sweat is like exploding out of your shoe.
Yeah.
It's like, that's
you got to change them at halftime or even on the, it's disgusting. It's really doesn't, especially because this guy's got big. Once guys got routinely over 300 pounds, so much about it, like, counterintuitively made players more fragile the bigger they got.
Right.
Because back in the Junction Boy days, when defensive linemen weighed 225 pounds, you know, you could do 3 a days out in the College Station heat or wherever they went for the Junction. Was it Junction, Texas? I'm guessing. Wherever they were for the Junction.
That sounds
boys.
Right.
Guys were more durable because they shed heat better. But once everybody got up to Corey Stringer size, you physiologically can't do the same things that they did back in the day. And I would include in that, like, Mike Evans as a wide receiver. Mike Evans, I'm just guessing, like, probably would have been the biggest wide receiver in the NFL in any given year back in the 1950s and 60s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. And they have a lot of guys like that there.
They had to take a lot of abuse back then, though, too.
You waiting for me to chime in on what my experience was like playing football in the 1940s?
No. Let me wrap up our talk about Tampa with some actual football talk. Where are you on the Tampa Bay Buccaneers right now? Can they actually genuinely threaten in the playoffs? Now that you're seeing them beat, at this point, midway through the third quarter, they're beating the Detroit Lions, who are using their third-string head coach and their second-string quarterback, 47-7.
Yes.
Because if the Tampa Bay Buccaneers had to be put to the test of the College Football Playoff Committee, they'd be really struggling because they don't have any quote-unquote quality wins. They beat the Green Bay Packers, but other than that, all of their wins are not against, I don't know, like, the equivalent of a top 25 team in college football. So I don't know if the committee is going to – I don't know if the committee would put them all that high in the rankings due to their lack of quality wins.
I just feel like that might be true across the board with everyone, though, this year, where it feels like once we get closer to the playoffs actually rolling around, like, I don't envy whoever the odds makers are this year for all the lines across the board. It doesn't feel to me like anyone is that much of a lock to begin with. So I could absolutely see Tampa doing it too. And plus, I just have like a deep, for no specific reason, I hate the Lions and I don't really know why anymore. Maybe it's because I'm just used to seeing Patricia there.
Yeah.
And I just do not like seeing him on the sideline.
Hateable.
He's just so hateable. It's just so he contrasts whatever your idea of what entitlement is supposed to look like, but he is entitled. It's like he looks like a slouch who doesn't look the part, but he totally is entitled in every
way. Oh, no,
way,
no, no. So. You know what? He does even look more entitled these days because as marijuana has replaced alcohol as the drug of choice among young people, it used to be that, like, oh, the privileged Harvard kid would look like, oh, dapper and everything, like a Dudley Moore type or something, all, you know, like the frat guy from the 1970s wearing a bowl. Now it's turned into like, oh, you're so entitled that you're just sloppy as hell, you know, and you got Seth Rogen posters up in your dorm room instead of Bo Derek. This is the whole, it's an emasculated, the damn marijuana has sapped up all the testosterone out of these poor kids.
No, I like that. I like that you coming in with the most old man take ever, that young people smoking their grass, just taking our jobs, not even doing it like you're supposed to, not even wearing a tie. My grandfather wore a tie every day for 40 years.
I'm not even judging it, Drew. I would say this brand of entitled stoner probably commits fewer assaults on like various other people. Like I would think they're like a less aggressive version of the frat boy from the 70s and 80s.
Well, it's that he clearly had one, you know, stint on his resume that enabled him to essentially have any other kind of behavior. And still
I forgot
that job.
Plus, he also had an allegation back in New Mexico on spring break in college. So I take back my previous theory about the stoners being more calm. No, I think you're right though, because if you look at I'll look at my last week's power rankings in the AFC, the Chiefs, the Bills, the Steelers. The Chiefs are not nearly as dominant as they were last year. Or well, because there are stretches where they weren't that dominant last year either. They just haven't looked as impressive. As you expected them to. They haven't just been steamrolling people despite the 13-1 record. But even if you just like they're firmly at the top of the AFC.
Right.
The Bills have come around to where they are right now. There were serious questions about their offense not too long ago. I feel like people have amnesia about what they were saying about the Bills just 5-6 weeks ago. And then the Steelers, my God, I don't know if the Steelers are going to score a point in the playoffs now.
Right. I mean, and I guess that's what I'm saying. I mean, is it going to surprise anybody when the lowest seed upsets somebody this year? I mean, I just don't know that it will. I mean, you can catch anybody on an off day, it feels like, this year more so than in the past.
I think I'd have to go up to, like, right now, as we stand here on a Saturday, so this will change, everybody, so bear with us if you're listening to this a few days from now. But, like, right now, the Dolphins and the Cardinals are the seventh seeds. I don't think they would necessarily have an upset in them. But the Colts and the Bucks, who are the current sixth seeds, I totally could see.
Right.
And then the Rams, I don't know. The Rams, what the hell? I have no idea what the hell they
are. Can't tell. Yeah.
They're the closest, I think, that the Bucks would have come to another quality win, but they're so bipolar that I don't have a clue. The other thing
and then it's like which conference is really, can you really tell that much of a difference top to bottom on which one is, you know, versus maybe in past years where I don't know.
No.
I can really tell.
The only thing we can tell is the NFC East is just the worst.
Is the worst.
Yeah. They're like whatever they're the sidekick to the stoned out privilege. Exactly.
Yeah, they're the one that's always available to hang out and get into trouble.
You know what they are? They're like the super rich kid. They're Dan Snyder. They're like they're like the guy that's in that like really annoying rich kid frat, but this kid's only in because he's the richest. Like all the other entitled rich kids hate this kid, but he's so rich and like his, you know, all four previous generations of his family were in it, and his father like owns a beer company, so they get free beer for all their they drink the beer because they're all at the ganja.
Yeah, but, and he paid his dues, you know, four years in full in advance.
Seems like the rich kid frats are into cocaine. That's a whole different level than
I didn't even know
that was an actual possibility in college. Like I had no clue college kids did that stuff until I rubbed up against a couple of those types of
right.
I got freaked out. The sight of cocaine scares the hell out of me, Drew. I don't, to this day, I'm 45 years old. If I sense that there's cocaine in the room or about to be, I get the hell out. I get paranoid as hell. Nancy Reagan gets in my ear and I can just
right, yeah.
I said, somebody in here's a narc. I'm getting out of here.
Yeah, immediately all those Just Say No to Drugs campaigns like come flooding back to you all at once. You're like,
after
oh, man,
school specials.
I'm about to lose everything. I'm about to lose everything. I just know it.
I OD'd off of secondhand
pasta.
Right. Yeah.
Secondhand cocaine dust.
I was the exact same way. I immediately just saw it was like every scene from every movie growing up that depicted it. You know, I was like, oh man, I'm definitely Johnny Depp and blow. God, man, there's probably a Fed somewhere.
Yeah, you think you're being tailed on the way
Yeah,
home.
I'm being tailed. I know, they're going to know I was here. They're going to know it. They're just going to know. And if they don't know, I'm just going to call and tell them.
I'm going to get in front of this thing.
I, you know what? We got to get in front of this and set the story. Why was I there?
Officer, I was close and I could have done it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Don't put this on my permanent record or tell my
mom. Do you want
mom.
Me to turn those guys in? I mean, I can. Yeah.
The other thing I've decided from watching this Bucks game is that Rob Gronkowski's physique is my desired physique. That's what I'm going to go for. I'm going to put up a poster of Rob Gronkowski on my mirror like every morning. That's what I'm going to look at and try to get to Rob Gronkowski physique.
Is that an option? I mean, he's like 3 inches taller than I think.
I know. I'd have to shrink it down. I feel like Gronk's like 6'6", 265. I feel like I'd have to be like 6'6", 245, right?
Right.
Like subtract about 10. Because I think he's pretty – I think a lot of times people think of him as being bulkier than he actually is. He's pretty – I don't want to say skinny because he's got a lot of muscle and everything, but he's pretty lanky, right? Or svelte.
Yeah, he's lean, and he's not carrying a lot of extra weight, actually.
He's not – right, but he's not bulked up the way some tight ends are, like even the more chiseled tight ends. He's not – he's sinewy. I want to be sinewy.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's, I don't know if follow up to sinewy. I'm like, quick, what's a different word that sounds also strange?
I thought about being The Rock for a little while. I follow The Rock and James Harrison on social media. James Harrison lifts too heavy. I can't be doing that. That's why I got a hernia as I watched James Harrison on Instagram. And then The Rock, I don't want to body shame The Rock, but if I have to, I will. Frankly, too veiny and too muscular for me.
Oh,
I don't think
too vascular for your taste?
Too vascular and too muscular, which I could look like The Rock, totally. I just choose not to because I want to look good in a suit. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about his traps are just at a level that I don't know where that comes from. I don't have that kind of trap game anywhere in my DNA. There's
That's
no
why
way.
I don't believe, like, I think he says he weighs 265, but I don't believe it because he's a big guy. I mean, he was a defensive lineman. He's like 6'4", right?
Are you not shocked when people tell you that you look at and go, you're 300 pounds? And then they tell you they're like 230. And I think, I must be much fatter than I realized because I'm like 280. Like, I think I look all right. And then I'm looking at him going, oh, I'm 50 pounds heavier than you. I'm much, much too generous with how I look at myself. I must be way fatter than I realized.
Oh, my other question I had for you, I just, in case you had an answer for it, how does Chase Daniel keep getting jobs?
I don't know. He goes in the same bucket as a handful of others. I have no idea. He dated everyone's daughter.
I think he's like a good dude. You know, he's probably like Doug Peterson was, right? Because Doug Peterson had jobs forever. And I think a lot of his time at Greenway was just probably because they felt like, oh, he'll keep Brett Favre on track. Like he can hang out with Brett Favre, but not he'll maybe get him home on time. You know, like that kind of personality. Like he's like, Doug will be a good time and everybody likes him and he'll know the offense, but he'll also keep an eye on Brett Forrest. I don't think Chase Daniel needs to keep an eye on Matt Stafford or anything, but I think there's kind of like a good guy thing there.
Yeah, there's a handful of teams that seem to have that kind of setup with like some kind of like handler who's always just kind of making the rounds.
Yeah. The other quarterbacks, I get Chase Daniel getting paid as a backup. Quarterbacks that get paid as potential starters that I just don't get are, well, it continues to be Nick Foles and, what's his name? Oh, Mike Glennon. Mike Glennon, I didn't get it all. Like Mike, and they all seem to rotate through Chicago at some point, but Mike Glennon getting that big contract in Chicago. And I think he's got a pretty healthy contract in Jacksonville right now.
That is the best example. That one is baffling. That one I don't get. The Nick Foles thing, I mean, look, they won a Super Bowl. Like once you have Super Bowl attached to your name, it's hard to shake that.
Well, and his two good stretches were so good that every quarterback coach and the offensive coordinator thinks, well, I can get it out of him. Like, none of these other coaches and these other systems can't quite do it, but I'm the different guy. Oh yeah. And see, Mike Glennon right now is making, I think he's making $1 million this year in Jacksonville, $1.1 million. So the other guy, if we're talking about Generation Z and what types of entitled stoners there are and whatnot, the story that I saw this last week, and I came to it late. I didn't even realize this until a couple days after the football weekend. And this kid's not an entitled stoner whatsoever, but Josh Jacobs, the running back for the Raiders, he kind of trolled fantasy owners because apparently fantasy owners haven't been all too happy with him this season, and they've been taking it out on him pretty hard. And by that, I mean, I don't know what percentage of fantasy owners actually like at Josh Jacobs. I'm guessing like maybe less than 3% of actual fantasy players will at their player like an angry text or an angry tweet. Does that sound right? Like, I don't think many people are just like adding Josh Jacobs and saying, you asshole, I can't believe you're sucking or whatever.
I mean, if there's anything that's more fruitless, it's ever assigning percentages of a whole of an entirety of people that do anything online.
Yeah. Right?
But okay. Yeah. Like, I mean, I'm with you in that our entire reality is driven by the loud minority.
Yeah.
So it's for sure. It's like 5%.
It's small. So yeah. Josh Jacobs before the game last weekend, I think on Instagram, I can't ever tell if it's Instagram or yeah, it's Instagram. He tweeted out or Instagrammed out this phrase, "Sorry guys, I'm not playing today," crying games emojis. So, you know, naturally everybody scrambled to adjust their starting lineups and whatnot. And Josh Jacobs ended up playing and wrote, let's see, a lot of hot fantasy owners afterwards, and underneath said like a little, I'm trying to read it here, middle finger emoji to some guy that apparently O'Neal or something. I don't know. This is what he wrote. Oh, well, middle finger, yo, fantasy. So Josh Jacobs just had it up to here with fantasy football owners and the way that they're treating him online. This is where I'm disappointed with Gen Z, because I hold Gen Z up here, Drew. I hold them in high esteem because they've grown up with smartphones. They've grown up on the internet. They simply have more experience than we do. And like, sometimes I listen to them and I believe them when they say, oh, that doesn't bother me, or no, like the trolls don't get to me, or if you ain't got no haters, you ain't popping. Well, clearly Josh Jacobs is being bothered by like all these trolls, and because of the trolls, he's punishing like the silent majority of people that just want to play fantasy football and did think highly enough of him to draft him at some point. And by the way, he rewarded the people that like were late to bench him by going for 49 yards on 13 carries, 3 catches for 25 yards with no touchdowns last weekend.
right.
Yeah. So he's like, hey, you know, like, oh, sorry. Yeah. You really missed out, I guess. You know, like he actually unintentionally ended up doing everybody a favor that did bench him.
Right. Which is really cuts to the heart of what the actual problem is that he ended up not living up to the hype of the gauntlet that he threw down in trying to troll people. So, I mean, that's the real problem. Like, if he had really gone off, this would have just been prolific. But, you know, the fact that he kind of had a pretty middling to mediocre game is kind of the issue.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought of the irony of that he was trying to stick it to fantasy owners. Like, and again, people that believed in him for some reason. I'm not trying to make it emotional or anything. It's all a transaction, right? It's not like it's not like there's some kid in his Alabama sweater being like, oh, come on, Josh, I know you can do it this week.
Right.
But still, yeah, he ended up actually doing all the people that he was trying to screw over a favor by benching him.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of pull for, I think at this point, I'm like a big advocate for anybody who can be a disruptor to the social media like atmosphere. I mean, I think I'm into it. I guess I'm lumping fantasy football into that. I don't really play fantasy football, so it's easy for me to say I'd like to watch it like go down like a burning blimp. But I just wish he had actually performed. That would have been just awesome.
But it's also, you know, like
he wasn't able to pull that out.
I don't want to be now I feel like I'm turning into a grumpy old man about all this stuff. Cause I'll reiterate, I was not being grumpy about the stoners. I'm a fan of the stoners and I'm pro legalization. Cause I love tax revenue. And I love advertising things on the radio, so I don't give a damn.
The way you were able to walk that line right there was incredible. I'm very pro stoner because I'm so conservative. is what I'm saying.
No, you know what? As somebody who grew up a farmer though too, I also kind of want to stick to everybody who thinks that they're gonna stay getting rich by farming marijuana. Like right. Once it's completely right. Mainstream yeah. illegal, like it it's just over. Turns into any other yeah. cash crop.
Exactly.
Like it's like I'll be as rich as a soybean farmer. It's gonna exactly. be awesome.
Yeah, just yeah, exactly. Or everybody who was trying to get into the biodiesel. Like, yeah, yeah. I'm like, hey man, you got one golden window here.
They say there's a lot of money out. In corn. You know those right. you know those rich farmers riding around in their 1979 Fords and everything. Yeah.
Just wait till it gets commoditized, guys. Once you see, you know, the price of weed up there, we have it pricing out the barrels of oil, that the game is over.
But there is, I mean, fantasy football does, it provides a lot of revenue for people and their salaries and everything. So you're kind of spitting in the eye of the customer when I just want to reach out to Josh Jacobs.
Is it though?
No. Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. It's big.
Really?
It's their way to, it's the NFL's way to suck people in, especially with daily fantasy. Cause it's gambling, but they don't have to call it gambling. Like daily fantasy is just one. It's just like a half step removed from outright gambling. You know,
is that still happening though, to the degree that it was a few years ago? Like the regulations took the teeth out of that in kind of a big way.
It's gotten more mainstream. The league partners with FanDuel, I think. So like FanDuel pays a pretty penny to be a part of it. And yeah, because there were a couple of abuses, it got regulated more. So right. now people trust it more than, early on there were some of the employees that like knew the algorithms and everything and knew right. how prices yeah. were adjusted. It was some sketchy stuff, but that was because of that. Then it got cracked down on, I think. And it's now it's more on the up and up, but then, like gambling too. I've got a friend up in Chicago who does radio who said that their company got hit hard by COVID and the loss of advertisers, except for the legal gambling. Like the gambling revenue is huge. So
interesting.
Yeah. CBD advertises a lot now that that's pretty much yep. legal everywhere.
Right.
You know, and for anybody that doesn't know CBD, of which a product that I do not currently advertise, but that I've taken before, it's just like, it's one of the non-psychoactive cannabinoids in marijuana. So you don't get high, but it helps you with anxiety and inflammation and whatnot.
Right. Helps you, it's supposed to help you regulate like your sleeping patterns. And
have you tried CBD?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a wonder drug, and I think it really probably cures cancer. Also, I've read. If you want to sponsor me, I'm willing to say those things.
So Josh Jacobs, though, back to Josh Jacobs.
Yes.
Like I interviewed Josh Jacobs and he was really cool. I liked him a lot. And I think he's probably a really good kid. That's why I worry about the Gen Zs, because I do think that sometimes social media is such a big part of their life. But everybody's in denial about how much a big part of their life it is.
Right.
And I've seen this with some players that like they've left Houston and what they'll see, like for the most part, like DeAndre Hopkins, most people in Houston look at DeAndre Hopkins almost like as a tragic hero and a victim of Bill O'Brien's ego. So like they still love DeAndre Hopkins. I got my nephew a DeAndre Hopkins t-shirt for Christmas. It's a silhouette of DeAndre reaching up for that Hail Mary. I bought it from DeAndre Hopkins online shop. It was $50 and and I wish I hadn't spent it, but it's a nice present for my, I figured it was like, oh, this is D-Hop. It's probably like a badass, like super awesome fabric or something. That's why it cost $50. Like, no, it's that harsh, harsh cotton. Whatever that brand with a G is that like all those types of t-shirts are printed on, like a right. stock t-shirt. So I got him. So everybody loves DeAndre, but I'll see him sometimes on his Twitter and on his Instagram. You can sense that he's kind of chafing against some of the people that are reaching out to him and talking smack out of Houston.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, and I've seen it with like guys like Chandler Parsons when he left Houston, they kind of all of a sudden have this chip on their shoulder against the fans who largely love them, but they let a silent minority just ruin it for them.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's always the problem, right? It is funny though, when you see the guys like DeAndre Hopkins specifically, for sure, where the fans had a good read on how that all went down, especially now. And you see how they're perceived after the fact. It's very interesting. I mean, it was hard to ever keep a guy like that down, but not everybody. I mean, I feel like Arian Foster was another guy who had like a weird up and down kind of relationship with the fandom. Especially,
and he started off as just such a media darling, right?
Yes.
This kid out of nowhere.
Exactly. I mean,
he wasn't out of nowhere. Yeah. He's out of Tennessee, but he was an undrafted rookie.
Right.
And, you know, ended up supplanting a second round pick to become the starter. And everybody loved him. Oh, he's a philosophy major. Wow.
Right.
And it seemed like within about 2 years with Arian, it just all got to him, right? Like he just got sick of everybody hanging on his words and or criticized, like dicing up every statement he made and all that. And it just but he stayed on Twitter, but he definitely had a love hate relationship with the whole, like every aspect of it. Right.
Yeah. I mean, it was tough because I felt like as an outsider, and you can't ever assume, you know, what it's like to be in anyone's head, but it just felt like as an outsider, you were watching him in real time go through this process of figuring out exactly what this eccentric personality was that he was going to inhabit.
Yeah.
And he hadn't figured it out, but he was really selling you that he had. And you were like, I don't know. I don't know if you have figured it out. And then he would take that personal and you're like, okay, that's fine. Yeah, you can.
It's, you know what it is.
You're vegan and you're, I guess, also every religion. I don't know what's happening. I don't know what you want me to do. I'm not mad. It's fine. It's fine.
Well, it's hard. It's hard when you're a 24-year-old kid too.
Right.
Like
exactly.
It's just, yeah. I think that you're doomed. You know who else was like that? Was the tight end, Martellus Bennett. I think Martellus Bennett was kind of out there and kind of eccentric, and they want to be themselves. But then part of the problem, Drew, is, and the same thing happened with Arian, I think, is that it's really cool. People think it's really cool that they have their own personalities and they're interesting, except that the audience is a football audience. And it's like, this is not like an art house indie flick crowd. So
right.
At some point there's going to be there's going to be a certain portion of people that like football that are going to be into it and appreciate it. But then there's going to be like the other 75% to 80% they're like, what the hell is this? What the hell? Subtitles? I ain't watching no stupid movie about two French people doing all upset about World War I. What the hell is this? Yeah.
They're definitely doing their best to try to own that Venn diagram that crosses over between really passionate vegans and diehard fantasy football fans. You know, and you're like, man, I'm gonna get all 10 of those guys. And
I do, I feel me. If I were to ever speak at the rookie symposium, they don't do the rookie symposium anymore, but if I did, I think one of the pieces of advice I would get is like, listen, hey, until you don't say a word publicly about being a vegan until you've actually pulled it off for a year. Because,
right.
Because I see all you guys just be like, hey, I'm going to try being vegan and I'm going to tweet about it. And then all of a sudden they don't realize what they've done. Like they've opened the floodgates. All of a sudden they start getting written about like on blogs and everything is like this vegan athlete, that vegan athlete. And then they get asked questions about it all the time.
Yeah.
For the rest of their career. And
it's a great hack though, for a younger player. That is a good hack to try to immediately get some press and some attention. It's like I feel like it's any like Instagram model you see that's like mostly attractive, but then like once they put on a weird costume, now they got like 10 million followers. And you're like, okay,
from that niche,
I see what we did here. Yeah,
whatever that little cosplay was or whatever, something.
Totally. Yeah. I'm like, okay, cool.
And then you get kind of married to that. The vegan stuff is hard because I mean, some of the strictest, most disciplined people I've ever known as football players that tried to be vegan, like at some point they just caved. You know.
Yeah,
it's really exactly. Like it's possible, but you got to be so dialed in especially when you're playing a sport like football where there's just so much muscular damage week in and week out.
Right.
And like Tony Gonzalez is probably one of the most disciplined guys that's ever played in the NFL, and he had to add some fish and chicken back to his diet. You know,
it's a pretty inefficient way to keep up your energy. You know, that's a problem, is that it's not an easy way to do it. And I say that as someone who tried to do it and then was maybe the only person to get fatter and gain weight on.
I don't think you're the only person at all, because you think about, like, to get the amount of protein bread that you need to get, you know, and especially if you're not trying to drink powders all the time and everything. That's right. Football is just different than a lot of the other sports. I think, like, the most successful athletes that do it tend to be distance runners and ultra runners and such. And they are, like, rail thin. They don't need nearly as much total protein. But, right, like, if you're trying to take in 250 grams of protein in a day as a lineman, it's
how many loaves of bread can I eat, really, Seth, to do that? You know, 10.
You got a dry cough. You're going to be all right? You got the COVID?
Come on now. Stop.
Brandy's still got her dry cough. She got it. She got COVID, I think it was like the first or the second of the month. So she's way negative at this point, but she's still got the dry cough. I'm nervous that she's – and you know what happened to me, Drew? My Peloton workouts, you know, like I've got a record of all of them. Like I had some PR efforts a week and a half or 2 weeks after my hernia surgery. I started going a little too hard too soon, but like then I got COVID and I'm not anywhere close to what I was doing right after my hernia surgery. Like there's something going on where I'm not cycling through oxygen. Yeah, like my legs get tired really quick.
It's been not even 2 weeks since you've.
I just Drew, have you not? The way you just
gaslit me right there too, and I bought into it. I was like, oh man,
it's been
no. Oh, you're never going to be the same. Long, I'm like, it's been 9 days.
I know. I was out of quarantine like the 17th, I think. Yeah. 7 out of quarantine? No, but that means I first got my first symptom on December 5th. So it's been 3 weeks since I got my first symptom, which I don't know.
Which means you probably had symptoms for at least a week.
Yeah. No, I had symptoms for, I don't know. I was tired for at least 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Okay.
For sure.
All right, I'll give myself this break.
No, you're allowed. You're allowed to not immediately get up to the level you were right after you had surgery.
I was, I'm reading this book, Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins. He's a former Navy SEAL who did ultra marathons and everything.
Yeah.
It's let me ask you this. It's a very good book, and he's like a tough individual. But one of the things that comes up in the book was his disillusionment with Navy SEALs in general and the culture of the SEALs, because he's psychotic about his working out just all the time. Wake up at 3:30 in the morning, run 20 miles on your way to work, all this stuff.
Right.
And in his mind, he always thought that when he became a SEAL, everybody would be like him. But it turns out that no, a lot of guys in various branches of special ops and everything, they go through the training, but then they just want to focus on whatever they're going to focus on and not necessarily the psychotic physical training. But it got to the point, and he admits this part of it, like it got to the point where it set him apart within his unit, and like people kind of didn't look at him as even a part of the team. Like he was a Navy SEAL, but he wasn't a part of like the actual team, and it hurt him with his advancement. But even when you read it though, you can sense that he still kind of has a lingering resentment about that. And it made me think a lot about like football teams and football coaches with their insistence on culture right now. Like Bill O'Brien was obsessed with culture and being dependable, tough and smart. And in his eyes, DeAndre Hopkins wasn't dependable, tough and smart enough. I feel like David Goggins was so wrapped up in the physical training side of things that maybe he was almost blind to seeing what other people's contributions would be. And he had to feel like, no, this is the way it should be. And he couldn't get over the fact that like these other guys weren't just completely sacrificing their bodies all the time for whatever ideal he had in his mind. I feel like Bill O'Brien was that way with needing to have a certain culture. And a lot of these other Bill Belichick disciples are this way, where they somehow feel like the culture trumps talent, and it just doesn't. Like talent is going to trump culture. And like, you got to have talent first, and then you try to have the right culture. But you look at the Patriots this year. I don't think their culture is probably all that much different than it was last year, but they're a losing football team this year because they don't have as many talented football players.
I'm totally with you, but I do think that they're, as with all things, especially in football, which I think is a better example than a lot of other sports, is that there's a balance. I mean, there's just a balance. You just, yeah. There are too many examples of teams that lean really far into just always picking the most talented draft picks, just always trying to, you know, re-sign guys that are pure speed guys or pure size and power guys. And that's just not the way to do it. And I actually, for all their faults, which are many as far as just being like the most prolific cheaters ever, you know, the Patriots really did kind of figure out that you can get around a lot of the skill and pure talent elements of the game by just trying to lean on guys who are well-rounded.
Right.
You'd understand how to be in the right place at the right time. Like, there is a balance there. I'm totally with you.
But the difference but they go too is, though, far. The difference is that, like, one of the biggest differences, and this is where, like, all the guys that try to emulate doing it the same way as Belichick right. Is that there's no accounting for how good a coach Bill Belichick is.
Right.
Like that, agreed. That he can coach every position on the team better than the position coaches themselves.
Right.
Especially on the defense. Like those guys just get, they're better. You watch the defense every single year with the New England Patriots. You watch the defense's technique improve as the year goes on. Like I'll watch them week one and be like, oh, these guys are trash. And right. Then you check in on them in week 7 or 8. And like all these nondescript defensive linemen are dumping guys on their asses because they've just gotten better technique, you know?
That's exactly right. Yeah, the guys who came out of that tree, who you always talk to me about your favorite coach, which was Patricia, who's in Detroit. Yeah. And, you know, that's a great example where that's exactly it. It's that, yeah, they can try to bring that cultural change. Like O'Brien, it sounds like, tried to do the same thing in Houston. And it doesn't matter if they're not actually coaching each of the position groups to that level.
The problem with O'Brien also, though, was that he was paying guys way above market value just because they were dependable, tough, and smart. That was his big acronym, was DTS, dependable, tough, and smart. So he's paying guys like Whitney Merciless because he's a good dude,
right?
He's 30 years old, you know, and he's not producing the way he used to. He gave him a huge contract. They bring in the safety, Eric Murray. But I feel like in some respects, there's some coaches, these Belichick's disciples especially, that latch onto the culture side, because if you do it right, it is special and it is unique, but it just is never going to be enough to overcome the fact that you still, like in New England, you had Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. Those are like the two X factors that swing everything way to the other way. And you could get away with the right kind of guys, you could get away with not having as much talent on paper, but you always had those two guys making right. up for a lot of it too. And it just, you're not going to do that with Bill O'Brien, and then frankly, whether it's like Deshaun Watson or Matt Stafford or anybody else, like they're just not going to do it like Tom Brady did it.
No, and they still always had significant, like, talented players on those rosters. Always,
yeah.
They didn't have zero. I mean, they weren't making the moves of getting rid of the DeAndre Hopkins until after they were really kind of at the end of their career.
Yeah,
I mean, it's like, you know, they still had just excellent players on those teams.
I'm living in this misery of being. I've been in Houston now and heard all this dependable, tough, and smart stuff long enough. But I'm just, we don't talk about it on my radio show anymore. But since I never talked to you about it, I had to talk about it just for a little bit. One last thing I wanted to hit you with: this guy Kasin Rashid. I think he's an attorney on Twitter. I don't know why. He's a very popular on social media lawyer, so he must be very good at Twitter lawyering. But right. He asked a question: what's a pre-COVID social norm that doesn't need reviving post-COVID? And I'm skeptical that some of these are going to disappear completely. But tell me your feelings just as I go down through this. Buffets.
Oh man, weren't buffets kind of dying though before COVID anyway? Like
I don't think so.
You don't think so? You think they were still like living
strong? I think
you
grew out of them a little bit.
I'm projecting my own growth onto the rest of the country.
I've watched the same thing happens with sports radio all the time. People think like, well, nobody listens to sports radio anymore. It's because they've grown out of it. And actually right. like sports radio as a format is thriving. Like stations are proliferating. And people say, well, you have a podcast or where it is. Like, yeah, I know, we podcast our shows. Like we do.
Right.
We get more downloads than the podcasters do. Right. So I think that every now and then people grow
out.
You sound
defensive, Seth. You sound defensive.
Oh, no, I'm not. That's just the life cycle. They always come back. This is what happens is they grow. They think they grow out of it to where they don't need it anymore because they're above that. And then they go off and they read Kierkegaard or something, or they're really, right. You know, they're listening to Bloomberg, and then they come back to their dark master, which is just the
right.
Sports. They can't get away from it. So yeah. That's how you are with buffets. At some point, you'll go back to it.
What are the
when
buffets
you're 65.
Then? What is it like country buffet and like Luby's, I guess.
Well, Golden Corral is the pinnacle of the mass buffet, we're not talking like a fancy buffet at a hotel on a Sunday or anything. Golden Corral does like a lot of their stuff fresh. I speak this as a former Golden Corral owner.
No,
investor.
You sound familiar.
No, I think they're doing it. I think buffets will be back too, cause it's just a good deal. It's such a good deal for people.
I guess the thing with all of the rituals, or I guess the like pre-COVID, you know, whatever the social norms were, is that I just feel you can never underestimate the inertia and the stubbornness of Americans. Like we will always keep doing, like, we're in the middle of it and people are not into the masks.
Right.
Else. Like, I think most of them probably are ultimately going to stick around.
That is, I think, especially, I think people are going to be more careful as they get older than maybe they were before, because I think people will still associate, well, okay, if I've got some underlying health conditions, I know the flu isn't as bad as COVID, but it can be I think that we will see selective mask wearing. It's not going to be like to the level of Asian cultures where they get sick, they just slap on a mask. But I think some people will, just because they've kind of been introduced to it. But it's not going to be omnipresent or anything.
Like, which one do you think is definitely on the ropes?
I think handshakes are going to be fist bumps at least. I think.
How have you been doing? Have you been doing fist bumps?
I've been doing just like, I don't know. I almost do like a little kind of, it's almost like, you know, when the water boy was trying to learn how to tackle the first time, and when Henry Winkler tells him to tackle him, he kind of like goes sideways in. Right. That's I kind of do that, but like from a distance, I try to feel people out. Like, but then I've instinctively, just without thinking about it, shook hands a few times. So I don't know. Yeah. Once that goes back, I try to be conscious of it all the time.
Well, what's interesting is that you learn real fast, like what the power dynamic is between any two people or any kind of business interaction.
It's like if the guy just walks up and like,
and goes to do
it, out,
you're going to do it. You're going to shake your hand. If you're into like the subservient or the needy role, like you're going to shake the hand. You're going to shake the hand.
Maybe it's a power move though, to be like, sorry, bro. And then do the Fonzie thing where you put your thumb through your hair. Like, stick it on the gas, psych.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and then just let him stare at you intently and hope you get in a car accident on the way home.
Then there's times where, because I always try to be very, very conscious of it, of, like, just being sensitive to whatever anybody else feels about it. But then I do feel like sometimes people look at you almost like, I don't know. You know what it is, Drew? I think we are at an all-time high of people misreading other people's emotions about stuff. I think that people walk into a store and they're convinced that either A, people are jeering at them for wearing a mask, or B, jeering at them for not wearing a mask. Like, I feel like every single person feels conspicuous, and then maybe not as much as before. Cause now it's like, if you wear a mask, you wear a mask, you don't think too much about it. But I think for like a good 4, 5, 6 months there, everybody was convinced that the other people, and it was fun because it was almost like walking around like in a Cold War movie, because I felt like I would be walking through. I noticed this one day when I was at Home Depot, like 3 different times I would be walking past a couple of people, and they would like quiet down their conversation real quick, because you know they are either talking of like either pro or anti Trump, whatever it was, they were having some discussion or about COVID, like, or they're either talking about Trump or they were talking about their theories about COVID or something else. But everybody kind of like, it felt like I was in a spy movie. Like, everybody is very careful and they're looking around like, all right, well, I don't want to hear somebody talk too loud about this, because the jackbooted thugs will come take me away.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think the level of I don't even want to call it like self-awareness, because I feel like that's just way too flattering, but is probably just the introspection, just the constant everyone thinking everyone's always looking at me at all times.
Yeah.
Is definitely dialed up. I mean, more so than it ever has been in my life. I mean, I think there's also there, you were talking about, was it Groggins? Brian Goggins,
who, I think.
Goggins, yeah. That's right. You know, I don't know if you know who Tom Nichols is, but that's another guy. I've been like recently reading his book called The Death of Expertise. Uh-huh. And it just has never felt more apropos, where right now everyone is an expert because no one is. And so that's what it is. Every conversation is just two experts just out experting each other with every like moment.
Well, and
then I walk by and go like, you guys are both idiots. I'm an expert.
Oh yeah.
because I am the expert.
And all three of you might have been pulling information from different sources.
Right.
And maybe one of you actually does have accurate information, but the other person just has a whole bunch of out of context stuff, or the third one might just be making stuff up and there's no way to check it. Like, we have no common basis on which we can have these discussions, because everybody's getting all their information from different places, and you don't know like what that person's bullshit meter is as far as whether it's right now I'm depressed. Sorry. Okay. Exactly. Handshakes. I think handshakes come back. He says working in offices. I think working in offices definitely comes back, but it's the inventory. I don't think all the inventory gets sucked back up, because a lot of companies realize how much more efficient it is to Zoom it.
I totally agree. I think if you're in a more service-based or sales-oriented sort of industry or business, I think you're going to see a huge downtick in how many people actually are commuting into offices. I think that's something that I think is going to, but I mean, it's, you know, I think that's going to be, because it also lines up nicely with, you know, the overheads that go along with running a business and running a company. I mean, they're going to be glad not to have to pay.
Oh yeah. No, especially think about some of these companies right now is they're trying to adjust their budgets for next year.
Right.
And they're trying to figure out like, okay, well, are we going to renew the lease? Like, how many leases are up right now where companies are saying, well, we're kind of managing all right now. Right. So no. And I think like once you go, I mean, you do lose something by not having that face-to-face interaction. I think a lot of tech companies, it's ironic that I think tech companies need a lot of the face-to-face and kind of the random chance conversations that people have. I think that ends up
like on the development side.
Yeah.
Right? With like creatives. Yeah. I can see that. Yeah.
See, REI, not that they're a tech company, but they're like pretty forward thinking. REI had just built this huge headquarters out in the Pacific Northwest somewhere that was all based on, you know, trying to make it feel like you're outside and very easy to be active. They're selling it because they said they realized like, oh wow, you know what? We're realizing like, REI does some really cool stuff. I actually would want to work for REI. But they realize that, you know what, we want our employees to have as much possible time as possible to be outdoors. That's what our company is. And if they're commuting at all, or if they're spending time inside, we'd rather have them be working from home. So like,
it's interesting too, because companies like that have really understood just what the premium is that employees are willing to put on not having to commute and not having to go into an office. Yeah. And so it alleviates a lot of the awkward, difficult conversations around compensation, where I feel like they look at it like, we can put this off for another 2 years by letting this person spend more time with their family, be at home, and we get that sweet, sweet buzz of being an evil corporation. So it's a win-win for us.
Right? You think do you think there are a lot of, okay, when it comes to compensation or just a lot of these discussions about allowing people to work from home, it's probably a lot of times like management is sitting there thinking like, this guy's really valuable and this is what he wants instead of a raise. Like, yeah, sure, Susan, we'll let you work from home. I guess like they're feigning grudgingly allowing it because
absolutely
they're thinking like, okay, yeah, I mean, I was ready to give you a 10% raise, but you just want to work from home. Yeah.
No problem. Yeah. And I can keep you around and we can delay that conversation for another 2-3 years. Absolutely.
Somebody says, one of the responses was working while sick. I'm wondering about that one, because companies have known for a long, like we get memos all the time from our head boss, like way before COVID, especially because in radio, you know, if a DJ gets sick or a sports talk host gets sick, then they're screwed completely.
Right.
So like, Sarah Fraser has always been very adamant about like, listen, if you've got, if you're sick, stay home. We don't want you coming in. But I feel like she's probably the minority. I don't think she's. I think companies have known for a long time that sick employees coming to work end up hurting productivity. And yet
right. There's
always that immediate need to have somebody there that I don't think that's going to change all that much compared to pre-COVID.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, I think that's kind of been changing over the last several years.
5-day school weeks. I don't know. A lot of places are already doing the 5-day school weeks. I think you go back to having that. Parents don't need these kids around any more than they already are. It's a pain in the ass.
What you're saying that the 5-day school week has been on the decline previously? Are there normally not 5 days?
Because of COVID, he's saying that people are saying that 5-day school weeks are a thing of the past. But I think that, I don't know. I think that most school districts are doing 5 days a week right now, aren't they? Some of them will do like 2 days at home and 3 days in class, or they'll stagger or something.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't have kids. Maybe kids won't be a thing anymore. We'll just go all the way in. There just won't be any more kids.
Standing closer than 6 feet. I think a lot of people want them to be standing closer than 6 feet. Dude, I would love it if everybody stayed 6 feet apart always for the rest of time, because I get kind of claustrophobic. But that's already, like, you talk about that going by the wayside. Even Sean, did you notice, Drew, one of those commercials, one of the holiday commercials that they've been showing on during a lot of football games, I can't remember which company it is, but it's kind of these sentimental scenes of people, you know, people filtering into a shop one at a time and everybody wearing masks and everything. And
right. It's
uplifting, but it's touching. But then the very last scene they pull out, and it's people lined up to get into this one shop because they're only letting a few in at a time. But everybody's like 2 feet apart. Like, there's just, I've noticed this many, many times. Like, when people are taking conscious steps to try to look like they're doing things the right way, they botch the 6 feet completely. And I'm not even judging. Sure. Like, if you're outside, whatever. Like, but I don't think people have a really good sense for how far 6 feet actually is.
I don't think they do either. And I also think that plays really neatly into everyone's, and I don't know if this is specifically American, but just kind of like that human urge to always like break the rule a little. Like, everyone kind of wants to break the rule. Like, no matter what the speed limit is, you're going to go like 5 miles over it.
Yeah.
So it's like, stay 6 feet apart. And you're like, or four or two.
I've noticed when you're in a store, when you're in a store and the 6 feet markers are marked out, everybody's like 2 feet in front of it.
Yes.
Like, you're just, even though you're still 6 feet apart, you're still like, but I'm ahead of the curve a little bit. It's like going 2 miles an hour over the speed limit.
Right.
Blowing out birthday candles. That's an interesting one. That seems particularly gross now. I think I'd been headed that way for a while, especially kids. They can't control their spit at all, you know?
No.
I don't know. Yeah, that might have gone by the wayside. I think what you should try to do is blow it out through a mask on your own separate little cake.
Yeah, or just like use something else, like a like one of those old timey things that you use to keep a fire going.
Oh, the what's that called?
Yes, the billows.
A billow. Yeah. hard pants, which they define as pants without elastic.
Which, by the way, have you ever heard of that? Have you called them hard pants?
I thought hard pants is like when you're wearing like hard clothes, or like denim clothes or workwear, like a Carhartt jacket. That's like, it's kind of, I read this article about how like hard clothes are kind of making a comeback because like everything now is super soft and high tech fabrics. And you realize, like, for one, it's super comfortable, but nothing shows off my 45-year-old bitch tits quite like that. Like a dry fit shirt, you know, like, thanks for this. Like, super comfy. Like, look at my mammaries here, you horny bastards.
Like, hope you appreciate my side boob.
So the article is talking about how wearing hard clothes is actually kind of more liberating and freeing. Like, if you're wearing like a Carhartt jacket and some hard denim jeans that have a little bit of bag to them, you can just let it all hang out. Nobody sees, you know?
Yeah. I also have noticed that is kind of the, that's like the uniform of choice for a lot of like tech professionals.
The Carhartt stuff?
Yeah, just kind of that.
Or just workwear?
Yeah, workwear. Yeah. Like, it's like, what's the most obvious way I can compensate for like being a back-end developer? Is like by wearing like 40 layers thick of denim and flannel.
It's always been a little bit of a hipster thing to wear hard denim and to wear like workwear, like wear an actual like a mechanic shirt or something like that. Which
a chain wallet.
But then, like, now you're in a, yeah, chain wallet, right? But now you're in a phase where Carhartt's actually kind of, I think, mainstream fashion, I've noticed. I've seen a lot of people wearing Carhartt. Where I wouldn't, so I wonder, does that hurt the hipster appeal? Like, the kind of punk appeal of it for a while until it goes back to being that? Yeah, I don't know.
It for sure does. It's like all those trends. I mean, they're all, it's all transitory. Like,
I got it.
Yeah, they're not all getting on combines and managing, tending to the cornfields.
Let's see. Oh, you said all things airport etiquette. You said, well, handing people their luggage, opening door. Did you write this? Helping them on the plane?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think now when people are getting on planes, everyone is going to be as apt to just grab each other's luggage and hand it to each other, or grab the bags off the carousel, or do
okay,
all that.
How do you feel about grabbing people's luggage, including way before COVID, I was really conscious of looking like, oh yeah, here, a young miss, you know, like I didn't want to be a male chauvinist or something. I always felt like that was like the equivalent of man, like the physical equivalent of mansplaining. Like if a woman had a heavy bag or something, like I want to help, but at the same time, like that's like, I have no qualms. Like if a woman gets offended at me holding a door, like, all right, fine. I hold the door for everybody. Like, I don't worry about whether they get offended at me holding a door, because like that, I do that for men and women. Like that's not me as a, like thinking that she's too weak to hold the door open.
Right.
But if I see like a 95-pound woman with a really heavy bag and she's like 4'11", I feel like almost a compulsion to help out with that. I'm 6'4".
And do you not do it? Don't you feel like the judgment is much riskier now, not helping and everyone looking at the biggest guy on the plane?
Like just
going like, really? Like, I know. Really, Seth Payne, who hosts a radio show and I recognize you immediately?
But would I do it for like a 4'11", 95-pound man? I feel like that would be emasculating to do to him. Like, 100%. What am I going to be like
for a man?
Like, hey, you want me to help you with that, champ? You know,
which you can't do it for a man, which is why you grab the man by the hips and you lift him up and let him high enough so he can put the bag into it himself, like
that's,
anybody would do
that's
to help.
A dignified way to do help. It.
That's the
like
more
a master blaster type of situation.
exactly. And then when someone blows the whistle, it calms you down, and then you sit down in your seat.
I guess no. What I try to do on planes is I try to feel it out. Like I try to make eye contact. Like kind of like, do you want help with that? And then that runs a risk of just being creepy, right? Like
flaring your eyes dramatically. Yeah. Oh. Do you want help?
I leer at them until they request help or look away. Yeah.
Until you eventually get like a comment to the stewardess. Sir, can you stop leering at everyone? Oh. I'm trying to be helpful.
And then I wink hard.
Exactly. And then you lick your lips.
Well, that was one of the ones I had skipped over. Men touching women at all. Now this feels like this isn't a COVID thing. This feels like a Me Too thing from like a year. This feels like a pre-2019. That
this
is
feels
definitely
like a stranger asking you for advice on just a completely different issue.
By the way, I feel like this guy constructed this whole thing just to find out if it's actually cool to touch women at the office again.
What an elaborate way to go around this, sir.
Well,
I see what you did there.
That had already changed, I think, ever since Me Too. And all like a lot of sensitizing. And I know I'm I never will, because I don't. It all it takes is if it's one woman out of 20 that for even in her like in her background or something bad might have happened to her, or maybe like as a guy, you can never assume that you're not giving off a creepy vibe.
Right.
None of us assume we're giving off a creepy vibe. But sometimes we do, like inadvertently I don't know. Like if a woman's been, especially like when some women, if they've been abused in their life, it doesn't matter. Like it has nothing to do with you personally. It's just like, they don't want a random dude.
Well, that's
touching him.
That's
on the
why
shoulder,
you. I always. Know? You always have to beat them to the punch. I just always report them for assaulting me. That's really kind of the only safe way to go about it.
Do you? But then there's like we have Ali Escobar, who is our weather person. She's very huggy and touchy feely, and it's it bothers her sometimes now that she doesn't get as many hugs. Like it feels like she needs she has like a physiological need to get many hugs during a day.
Right.
And it's just
do you still do it though?
You
feel like you have permission?
No. I totally have permission with Ali. That sounded weird.
she wrote you a memo. She checked it out with HR, and you're not allowed to.
Well, I made her sign a document.
Exactly. Yeah, you say you got it. You just went to LegalZoom.
We know each other because we spend time every day. Like we've just chatted. One thing we'll talk about is like how things look in a transcript. You know, like you always have to, whenever you're having a conversation.
Oh yeah.
Try to think of how your conversation actually looks in a transcript.
Oh, that'd be so devastating.
When you think, okay, how does this conversation look in a transcript? Then I try to take it one step further and think, okay. And then some people might actually interpret me saying this like the way it would read in a transcript. Right. Like when they hear it, they might interpret this that same way. So basically, I've tried to stop having any kind of personality.
Like, why is everything Seth says in the form of a proposition?
Well, I'm sorry. You know what? I was watching this. I was watching this YouTube channel that I like. It's called Charisma on Command. It's really interesting stuff. They break down a lot of there's just different ways to interact with people and different methods for conversation, debate, stuff like that.
Right.
But they'll break down kind of different celebrities and they'll show why they are engaging or, how they interact with people. And it's really cool. But he uses one where he breaks down Craig Ferguson and talking about why he's so engaging. The title is Why He's So Engaging. Then you get into the video and it's like, oh, no, this is how Craig Ferguson is so effective at flirting with women. And then I felt kind of weird watching because it felt like I was like I just ordered something out of a comic book, how to pick up women in 10 steps or something.
But was it you realized that's what it was with him being effective at flirting, or was it that was literally outlining?
Oh, it was literally it was all about him interacting with women. It wasn't him and his male guests or anything.
Yeah.
But so it was a lot of really good stuff. And it's all a lot of it is with is being very just non-threatening, and kind of feeling people out and him making fun of himself or making comments about himself and all that. And it's all very good stuff. And he's an incredible flirt. He's very good at it. But as you're watching it and you're thinking, yeah, but people are watching this video and they're not getting the disclaimer here, which is, look, you can try to act like Craig Ferguson, but at some point it's going to come off creepy. That's the risk you run. At some point, you just got to accept the risk, right? Yeah. Like it's going to be...
You're not going to be 100%.
Yeah. You're going to go a step too far a couple times and you're going to offend somebody. So just don't do this at work. You're interacting with women at a bar or at a party or something, but you got to be super careful about who
do it at a funeral.
Yeah.
Somewhere where someone's going to want to respond to it.
You should do it in places where you're almost guaranteed to offend, because then
you can really see how effective it is.
The 5% that don't get offended are super freaks. Those are the ones that are. That's the old Eddie Murphy. I think Eddie Murphy had a bit about that in Raw or something. Whichever one when he was wearing the all red leather suit.
Oh,
something about he would just he'd walk up to a woman and ask hey, you want to sleep with me? And he'd get slapped in the face. Then he'd walk up to another one. Hey, you want to sleep with me? He'd get slapped in the face. And somebody said, well, why would you do that if it only works 99, if it only works 1% of the time? He said, because that 1% is pretty damn exceptional.
Exactly. That's why I bet if you talk to Brandy about it too, or her friends, and they talk about, guys with just horrendous pickup lines or how strange dudes will hit on them or cheat them. It's it doesn't work on them. But it works on someone, and that's why they keep doing it.
It works on somebody, right?
That's
why they keep doing it. The cheesy guys are cheesy for a reason.
Yeah,
there's a subset of women that the cheesy stuff really works.
They would stop doing it otherwise. Guys are really good usually at actually trying to change up their game if it's not working.
Yeah, I think cheesiness is probably. If I had to go back in time, I'd probably try to be more cheesy. Maybe spend more time thinking about cologne and stuff like that, or showers at least.
Does that qualify as cheesy? Just general body hygiene.
Look at this guy. Yeah, that's how we were like.
So cheesy.
College. Look at this cheesy guy wearing cologne and hair product.
Look at the way he's always combing his hair.
This guy always just trying to hook up and successfully doing it. The cheesy bastard.
And he's doing it well. What a loser.
Yeah. All right, Drew. Well, the game has come to a close. The Buccaneers, they pulled it out. Spoiler alert, they won 47-7. So, yeah, Tom Brady, January Tom Brady, looks like he's swinging into form.
he's keeping it going. He's starting to warm up now.
I was going to do a monologue before this podcast, but we just talked for an hour.
Do you want to do it now? And then I'm gonna edit it.
Yeah. Hey, hang tight for 15 minutes while I monologue.
You're gonna awkwardly just cut.
You know. No, I won't. And that David Goggins book, it's called Can't Hurt Me. It's actually a really good book. I encourage anybody to read it. I feel like I gave kind of like a backhanded intro to it, like by giving a mild criticism of it beforehand. But if you want to get super motivated to go do a bunch of workouts that you're not actually ready to do yet in January after New Year's Eve, go read David Goggins' book.
That's a stellar endorsement.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.